Hello, everyone. My name is Christopher Patterson. I'm a doctoral candidate at the University of Washington, and I am the host of this podcast, New Books in Asian American Studies. As a discipline that emerged from the Third World Movement in the 1960s, Asian American Studies is fundamentally interdisciplinary, so we will feature books on anthropology, history, literature, art, political science, and sociology, all that help us understand the varied experience of Asian Americans living in or interacting with the United States. Today, we are joined by Dawn Mabalon. She is the associate professor at San Francisco State University. We will discuss her new book, Little Manila is in the Heart, The Making of the Filipino-American Community in Stockton, California, which was published by Duke University Press this year. Dawn's book depicts the Filipino settlement in Stockton, California's Little Manila as a remarkable and unique event in Filipino-American history. By covering a rich 50 years of Stockton's Filipino-American community, Mabalon shows that not all Filipino migrants were roving bands of workers who rarely settled in West Coast cities. With a sharp focus on a small space, Mabalon tells the story of Stockton as the story of Filipino America, showing how the town's history depicts Ilocano, Tagalog, and Cebuano immigrants who came together in the city to begin identifying as Filipino American. From the 1920s until the 1970s, Filipino Americans thrived in Little Manila's working-class 4-to-6-block area, which was comprised of rooming houses, pool halls, dance halls, grocery stores, barber shops, churches, and union halls. Mabalon's study reveals a space where sedentary Filipinos started families, churches, unions, and businesses, and where migratory Filipinos came to relax, meet old friends, dance, and gamble. Acting as a center of gravity for the emerging immigrant community, Stockton, over the decades, became a sort of capital of Filipino America. So I want to welcome Dawn Mabalon to the show. Dawn, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you, Christopher, so much for having me.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself, how you came to this project, and even your graduate school or where you come from.
All right. Well, I was born and raised in Stockton. I am a third-generation Diné. My maternal grandfather and my paternal grandfather, they both came from the same small town, Numancha, in Aklan Province in the Visayas, and they both found themselves in Stockton in 1929. And I talk about this in the book, all the different ways that my family then came together. On my mother's side, my grandfather went to fight in the 1st Philippine Infantry in World War II, met my grandmother, brought her back to Stockton. On my father's side, my grandfather left my father, who was 5 years old at the time, and his wife, and my father's brother and sisters, and came to the United States and then eventually brought them all back together over several decades. So I am a daughter, I guess, of Little Manila, a granddaughter of Little Manila. And I did my undergrad at UCLA, and it was there that I started really understanding my family's history and Filipino American history and my own life in the largest context, taking classes in Asian American studies and in Filipino American history. And it was this really golden time to be at UCLA. I really count myself as just so blessed. Mm. For one, we had Uncle Royal Morales, who was teaching the Filipino American Experience course, and he created that at UCLA, and I was one of the last years of students that he, you know, last cohorts of students that he had. He retired a few years after I graduated from UCLA. And he was just an incredible teacher and so dedicated to the community and just really was this example of how to be a scholar and a teacher of Filipino American studies and have your heart so deeply embedded in the community and to do it all for the best reasons and with the best intent and the most passionate kind of teacher. And that was amazing. And there were a lot of Filipino American graduate students on campus at the time, you know, wonderful mentors, people like Kathy Stiniza Choi, Linda Merrim, August Espiritu, Arlene De Vera, people who were ahead of me in history. And that was amazing to see as an undergraduate, you know, to go to UCLA and to have these Filipino American graduate students doing incredible work. And so in many ways, my book began there. I mean, I started doing oral histories with family for, you know, Asian American studies classes. And I had planned to become a journalist I was actually a writer at the Daily Bruin at UCLA, and I'd never even given one thought to becoming an academic at all. I was going to be a writer. I was going to be a feature writer, you know, a features writer, and do, you know, maybe do some writing on Filipino Americans at some point in time. But it never really crystallized that I should go on to academia until and until Kathy Sinuza Choi talked to me in office hours one day. I was taking the Philippine history course with Professor Michael Salmon there, and she was a teaching assistant. She said, you know, you should think about graduate school, you know? And that was really important for me because as a Pinay from a farmworking family, and also my grandmother and my mother were public school teachers, so, you know, I wasn't the first in my family to go to college. I knew that I was going to go to college. I just didn't think I would go on to get my PhD, and I didn't think that that would be a route that was even possible. And like I said, those graduate students that were there at UCLA and the master's students in Asian American Studies just, you know, really were wonderful role models for those of us who were undergraduates in the early to mid-90s, you know, to really creating the field that we have now, you know, and building the field and building on what was created for us by people like Uncle Roy Morales and the Filipino American National Historical Society and the Uncle Fred Cordova and Auntie Dorothy Cordova over at FONS, who I'll talk about in a second, if you can remind me to. But from there, when I was, you know, in my Asian American Studies classes, and the more that I kind of put my own family history and my community history in this largest context, I realized how much was missing in what we knew and understood and taught about Filipino American communities. The idea that Filipinos never settled anywhere, that we were just these roving bands of workers, and I think that was something popularized by Ronald Takaki in Strangers from a Different Shore, and he had based his narrative on Carlos Bulosan. And, I mean, I'll talk about Bulosan and his impact on Filipino-American history and studies in a little bit. But this idea that that was all that we knew about the community and that was all that was important just really struck me as strange, because here I had grown up in this large and vibrant Filipino community where there were women who had come over in the 20s and 30s. Women who had been war brides, women who were leaders in the community. And if there had been no Filipino communities and no durable institutions and no families, then how did I exist? You know, how did, you know, what were we saying about these communities like Stockton and Watsonville and Salinas and, you know, these Seattle, you know, these San Francisco, these old historic Filipino-American communities in which people are in the fourth and fifth generation. You know, my Uncle Fred Fons, you know, often said, well, that's the narrative of Filipino-American history, that it's just roving bands of bastards. And where did we all come from? Did we just suddenly appear, you know, second and third and fifth generation Filipino-Americans? So, you know, as I took these Asian American Studies classes and history classes, I realized how much I love teaching and how much I love doing research, and I decided to do my master's in Asian American Studies at UCLA. And again, it's really golden time to be there. I mean, you know, Uncle Roy was still there. Pauline Agbayani Stewart was a professor, a Pinay professor in social welfare. I had a wonderful mentor in Valerie Matsumoto, who's still there in the history department, who's done, you know, really pioneering work in second generation and culture and family and food, Japanese American histories. Henry Yu was there. Michael Salmon was one of my mentors. George Sanchez was just leaving. So this really, and Enrique Dela Cruz was also in the Asian American Studies Center there at UCLA. And so there was this really amazing and wonderful gathering of Filipino American graduate students, of professors, and then as an undergraduate there, it was also just the Samahang Filipino organization was vibrant and strong, and we started the Filipino American History Month celebration there. So just really, really blessed to be in this amazing Filipino American community, UCLA. And this book really started there, doing the oral histories with my family. There was one oral history I did with my dad's best friend, a man named Claro Candelario, back in 1993. And it was for the Filipino American Experience class, for Uncle Roy's class. And you know, he had been my dad's best friend for decades. I mean, I had known him, you know, I mean, he'd known me since I was a baby. And so I went and started to talk to him, and I told him that I had read America's in the Heart, and he said, well, you know, I'm in America's in the Heart. I'm the Claro character in America's in the Heart. And I was just,
yeah.
No, you're not. You're just rambling. You're just, you know. And then he showed me pictures of him and Carlos Bulosan, and if you look at Carlos Bulosan's papers and his plays, I mean, he mm-hmm. actually uses the name Claro for several characters, and it's always the same kind of character, a very educated, very politically astute person who was exactly what my Uncle Claro was. And so he had pictures of them together, and it was just, you know, it amazed me as a young undergraduate then. And I'm really, really happy to finally have the book out, and I can talk about my Uncle Claro and Carlos Bulosan and that connection that you know, and that tragic and tragically the fact that I had to go all the way to UCLA to read that book.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that's another reason why I think the writing of the book was so important for me, was that, you know, this, I really felt the privilege of being able to go away to school. Not many granddaughters of farm working families get to do that, or Filipino Americans in Stockton. And to be able to use my privilege and my resources as much as I could to bring this history, in a sense, you know, not just to the world, but back home, back to a place where not many people have access to it. I mean, there are no Filipinos, I say this in the book, you know, I grew up in Stockton not knowing that my father's friends were heroes in Filipino-American history. You know, my father knew Larry Itliong, you know, as a personal friend, as a lodge brother, you know, and I did not know who Larry Itliong was until I went away. And I think that's a tragedy, and that's something that, you know, I'll talk about a little bit later as we talk about what we do in the Little Manila Foundation. But I think it was the fact that I had to leave home to really understand home, and that this appreciation of this community that we built in Stockton, and, you know, particularly the labor activities of the labor organizing activities of the people in Stockton, the fact that more people outside of Stockton know about that, and people taking Filipino American studies and Asian American studies know about that than people in Stockton is a tragedy. And I tried to explore that in the book, too. So, okay, so after UCLA, I decided to go on and get the PhD in history. And I had wonderful mentors at UCLA that really believed in me and said, you know, you could do this. And again, at every step, I wasn't sure if it was the right step for me. I mean, like I said, most of my life I had wanted to be a writer. But a writer for magazines, a writer for newspapers. I'd been editor of my high school and my college. Community college newspaper. I'd been a writer at the Daily Bruin. I had interned at USA Today. I mean, you know, my whole path was in that direction. And I guess if I had known in the early 90s what print journalism and the future of print journalism would be, I guess I'd made pretty good decisions, right?
Well, you're on a podcast now. So.
Yeah, I guess. And that's where journalism has gone. But, you know, then I decided to move back up to Northern California to go to Stanford. And I think that was a really, really, really great decision to have done that. For one, I mean, Stanford was amazing. My mentor there was Gordon Chang and another advisor, Al Camarillo and Estelle Friedman. Just amazing, amazing people who had mentored the generation before me of ethnic studies scholars, people like Valerie Matsumoto, George Sanchez, Vicky Ruiz, Peggy Pasco, Antonio Castañeda. Had all gone to Stanford and studied under Al and Estelle and people like Judy Wu in Asian American Studies, you know, studied with Gordon Chang. And so I felt part of this really warm and embracing community of ethnic studies scholars, particularly Chicano and Chicana studies scholars. You know, when I was there, it was myself, Kim Warren, who's a professor at Kansas University, and she just wrote a book a couple years ago about American Indian and African American boarding schools in Kansas. And then another one of my classmates at Stanford was Maricela Chavez, who is a Chicana historian, and she's writing about Chicana feminism, and she's a professor at Cal State Dominguez Hills. And then there were also students ahead of us, people like Monica Parrales and Shauna Bernstein and Gabriela Gonzalez and Gina Pitti, women doing Chicana history. So we were just, you know, it was just amazing and warm and really, really supportive group of American historians who we were all women of color doing pretty radical stuff, you know, at the time in the late 90s. And we were all still friends and, you know, and I also, Asian Americanists that came after me, people like Shelley Lee and Cecilia Su, you know, I count myself so blessed to be part of, as you know, I felt like I was at these places in these really special times, UCLA in the golden years of having Uncle Roy there, and then at Stanford in this time that there were all of these people doing histories of their hometown. For example, Monica Parrales' book about Smeltertown, this award-winning book that came out last year, and she was also studying her hometown, you know, in near El Paso, Texas. And so the kind of work that I was doing was not this kind of far out there, crazy kind of work, you know, that it might have been regarded in maybe some more conservative history departments or departments that didn't also, you know, didn't have a history of producing some of the most, important scholars in kind of the new American history, right? You know, American history, Chicano studies, et cetera, et cetera. And to be mentored by people like Ala Camarillo and Gordon Chang and Estelle Friedman and Richard White also does a, you know, 19th century American Indian history. Just I'm so thankful to have been at Stanford and at that time with these wonderful people all around and helped me learn how to really be an historian. The kind of historian that, you know, they were the kinds of historians that I aspired to be. They're so just amazing role models. So, and I laugh. I talk about the book taking 20 years, but if you count from the time that I first started doing oral histories with my grandmother and my Uncle Claro, you know, really, I mean, I started doing that in 1992, and I used them for the book, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the dissertation I was writing from, you know, 2000 to 2004, technically, but really, I mean, what ended up in the book, you know, were bits and pieces of undergraduate papers and oral histories and really the last two decades trying to, you know, piece together the history of my hometown.
It does seem like a very, on the surface, one could mistake it for a kind of traditional project because it's about a city and the migratory workers there, but it's actually very ambitious once I started to read it. It's very transnational, the point of view. It compares a lot of different ethnic groups, like you said, with African-Americans and Chicanos at the time, which is also kind of unusual for an Asian-American book. And then it also focuses on the very cultural, everyday parts of the town. And, of course, Filipino women is a big focus of the book. And one of the reasons I think I connected with the book, too, is I'm a fourth-generation Filipino-American, so it was hard to kind of accept the Manong, I guess, narrative of the roving bachelor.
Exactly. You're kind of migrated. You're like, well, then where did my grandparents come from?
Yeah.
They never settled anywhere or had kids, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. But I was hoping you could speak a little bit more about how the historical narrative kind of developed, maybe about Bulosan. It is Bulosan's, I think, his centennial birthday this month, so it'd be interesting to hear about him constructing the kind of Manong narrative, Stockton shows something quite different from that. So, what is your kind of take on those historical narratives?
Yeah, you know, actually, we just had our Filipino American Book Festival here in San Francisco this last weekend, and we had a panel on the life and legacy of Carlos Bulosan, and it was I was really honored to be on it because it was Oscar, the famed writer Oscar Peñaranda was the moderator, and I was also on it with Dan Gonzalez, professor at San Francisco State, who teaches the Filipino American History course, and then my colleague and my best friend, Dr. Allison Pinzon-Cucubales, who teaches the Filipino American Lit course. And so we were talking about things like Bulosan's birth date and his legacy. So in terms of his birth date, on his original arrival record, his the ship manifest list, when he arrives his birth date is April 6th, 1912.
So we've all got it wrong.
You know, we were all laughing because in all these different biographies, Isan Juan's and Susan Evangelista's, I mean, you know, November or October, or even on his grave, on his headstone, I think it says 1914. So I have no idea. I would tend to believe the ship manifest because he's coming over as a really young kid. And I mean, he doesn't know at that point that he's going to have an FBI file. He doesn't know at that point that he's going to be under surveillance or that he's going to have to hide and not, you know, try not to get deported or so I'd imagine that would be the most genuine birth date, unless at that point he's also trying to make himself older or younger. Who knows? So anyway, so I guess we could say happy 100th birthday, Manon Carlos, but I guess, you know, whatever it is he wanted to be at whatever year. So, you know, it's interesting that we talked about Carlos Villafan's legacy because I felt like his book was one of the books that really frustrated me as an undergraduate because, again, where are the women? There is one Filipina in the book, and, you know, she was supposed to be at Stanford. It's interesting. She was supposed to be at Stanford, but then she had to drop out, and, you know, he comes he meets her, and it's like a surprise that, wow, there's a Filipina here in this entirely new community, you know. And it frustrated me because, again, it's those questions, you know, well, what about all the women in Stockton's Little Manila that you had to have run into, you know, that you had to, that I know you knew, because the more I talked about Bulusan with old-timers and relatives, I mean, it turned out that people that had never talked about their history finally were opening up when I was asking questions. You know, I would ask aunties and uncles, well, what about Carlos Villafan? Oh, yeah, we used to play pool, blah, 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 blah. You know? Oh, yeah, Carlos Villafan. Oh, yeah, he would always just, you know, he'd be drunk all day, and then he'd stay up all night and write, and blah, 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 you know. And then in that interview that I did with my Uncle Claro about his life, but he also talked about his relationship with Carlos Villafan, and he told me, oh, you know, Carlos Villafan never worked a day in the field.
You put that in the book.
What is that?
I like that part. I like that part in the book.
Yeah,
it's very revealing.
And that shattered, I mean, that broke my heart as an undergraduate, you know, because you read America's in the Heart and, you know, on the one hand, here was this amazing book that he actually talks about Stockton. He talks about El Dorado Street and here are Filipinos in print and Filipinos from a long time ago in print, you know, and then to find out that it was fiction. I mean, it was heartbreaking. And then you go, okay, well, if it's fiction, but he's also, you know, trying to create this history about the communities, then where are the institutions? Where are the communities? Where are the women? Where are the families, you know? So in many ways, this book was about the frustration, you know, the origins of the book. When I first started thinking about that, I really want to write a more nuanced and complex history of Filipinos in America, was born from this frustration with America's in the Heart. Now, what happens later is that the more research that I do and the more that I started to really create the book and think about the important turning points in this history, I realized how much Bulusan had written that was history. So he had missed all these themes that I was really interested in the book. But then there were also these historical moments that he talks about in America's in the Heart that really show that, you know, he was really trying to use this opportunity that he had with this mainstream press, with the book that he knew that was going to be distributed widely and published nationally, to really tell the history of Filipino Americans as he saw it. And so moments like, I talk in the book about a Japanese-American strikebreaker named Kei Morimoto, who essentially was hired by Sansei farmers to break the Filipino Labor Union, the Filipino Agricultural Laborers Association. And I went back to America's in the Heart, and after, you know, doing all my archival research and newspaper research and doing all histories about the strike, going back to America's in the Heart and realizing, oh, he did mention her. You know, he mentioned the strike, and he mentioned her. I was just too young to kind of, at the first few readings of it, you know, I kind of read it through for a few times and then kind of put it aside and then was like, okay, I'm going to do real research now, you know? And then going back to the book and going, oh, I should have paid more attention to to Carlos Lewis on talking about this woman, because perhaps I would have found her earlier if I had listened and written, you know, more about the strike. You know, and then in a sense, Carlos Lewis makes himself the Forrest Gump of Filipino American history in the book. I mean, he shows up, he happens to be in Seattle when the leaders of the Alaskan Cannery Workers Union are assassinated, right? And then on the one hand, you could say, well, he's trying to write himself into history, which is how actually a lot of his contemporaries thought, you know, oh, he didn't work a day in the field. What does he know about a pea strike? You know, or what does he know about going to work in Alaska, et cetera, et cetera? But stepping back, you realize, well, he's trying to tell this history that if he feels, and he feels that if he doesn't tell it in this book, people are going to forget. You know, nobody's going to know, and he's got to show these turning points. He wants people to understand that these are the moments in Filipino American history that were important. You know, the assassination of the union leaders, the breaking of the strike by Japanese Americans. He also talks about the death of Francisco Verona, and again, I write about the death of Francisco Verona, who was a diplomat in the resident commissioner's office that helped Filipinos in Stockton organize one of the first very successful labor unions, the one I just talked about, the Filipino Agricultural Laborers Association. But I, again, going back to Bulusan's book, he talks about him too, you know, and what an amazing leader he was and how tragic it was when he died. And he did die. He died very young from an aneurysm right in the height of the organizing that this union was doing. So this was a really heartbreaking moment for the Filipino American community. So I kind of, you know, in the writing of this book, I feel like my respect for, I was seeing Carlos Bulosan's Americans in the Heart as literature primarily, and a little bit of history, primarily from my kind of undergraduate and early graduate school years. And as I was writing the dissertation, I was writing this book, a really newfound respect and admiration for what Carlos Bulosan was trying to do as an historian. You know, so and the, you know, the irony of kind of writing this book because I was so frustrated with Americans in the Heart, yet this book ending up being kind of an homage to Carlos Bulosan, you know, is really, I think, kind of funny and interesting, you know, and the fact that, you know, and then in the research I did for this book, realizing that Carlos Bulosan knew my grandfather who ran the restaurant the Lafayette Lunch Counter in Little Manila, and that he had collected his mail there. I talk about this in the introduction, you know, and also the fact that, you know, I didn't get to understand or know Carlos Bulosan and appreciate him until I went to college, but our family had a first edition signed Americans in the Heart. But because there was no appreciation of Filipino-American history and of Bulosan's place, you know, I mean, this was the 60s. I mean, Americans in the Heart doesn't get reprinted until 1973. So, you know, my cousin uses it as her coloring book. It's kind of thrown around as scratch paper in the house. And when I was talking to my father about Carlos Bulosan when I was writing the book, he was like, oh, yeah, yeah. We used to have a copy of that. And it kind of got trashed. but yeah, so, you know, it's kind of stuff that people in Stockton, again, take for granted or don't think of as history. And I talk a lot about this in the introduction. I mean, because they don't learn, you know, there's no Filipino-American history in the K-12 system. There's no Filipino-American history class. There are no Filipino-American history classes at the community college or at the local private university, University of Pacific. I mean, you could literally pass through Stockton as a Filipino-American and not realize the significance of your town, your neighborhood, your community in the larger history of California or the nation. It's everybody else has history, but we don't. You know, we're not important. Yeah. We're just a bunch of farm workers, and whatever our grandfathers and uncles talked about, that was just, those are just ramblings of old men talking about cockfights and taxi hall dancers and, you know, stuff like that. So,
You did mention the other Filipino communities, I guess, where Filipino Americans settled, like in Seattle and San Francisco. So I think you're right that Stockton has kind of been missing from that narrative.
Yeah.
Even though, as you point out in the book, I think it was the first or the largest.
It was the largest Filipino American community on the West Coast for most of the 20th century. You know, and when I did oral histories with people, and I said, well, what about L.A.? What about San Francisco? And a lot of them would say, oh, no. It was Stockton that was fun. And that's kind of the irony for those of us that grew up in Stockton in the 80s, 90s, and just this last decade. I mean, we would give anything to go to a big city, you know, and have fun there. You know, even Sacramento was a big city outing for us. But for Filipinos at that time period, coming to Stockton was their big outing. So people would come from Seattle, from Los Angeles, from Salinas, and go to Stockton for the big 4th of July party or during the summertime when it was the height of the asparagus season, and every Filipino on the West Coast would be working asparagus, and Stockton was the headquarters. And so it helped me to imagine this amazing, vibrant community. Some people talked about, El Dorado Street being the Filipino freeway, that you would just cruise El Dorado Street and people would be waving at you and calling out at you, and you'd see your cousins and family and relatives. It was the ways in which that they remembered this community was so amazing and so heartwarming. For those of us that grew up without any memories of Little Manila, because so much of it had been destroyed. And again, for us who grew up in Stockton in the later part of the 20th century, imagining that our little town would be the center of Filipino America is, for our generation, it's hard to imagine, but it happened. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, that critical mass would bring even more critical mass, so that this little town becomes a center of this migration. And you know, people looking for their relatives would go to Stockton, and, you know, looking for cousins and, you know, coming right off the boat, knowing that they could go to Stockton, they would most likely find somebody from their town, if not their own relatives, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's begin getting a bit more into Stockton. First, through the Filipino woman that you write about. You devote quite a lot of time to them, and then they become very integral to the story throughout your book. So I'm just wondering, how did you settle upon that? And can you just tell us a little bit about how they were integral to the community and how they affected future generations of Filipino Americans?
Yeah. I did a master's thesis for the MA program at UCLA in Asian American Studies, and my master's thesis was on Filipino women in Stockton, and Valerie Matsumoto was my advisor. And I really wasn't sure if I was going to go on to do the PhD. And that was my direct response to Bulosan. All right, you're not going to talk about Filipino women and other historians of Filipino America. You're not going to talk about Filipino women, or I'm going to write a thesis about Filipino women in my hometown. You know, so at the time that I started writing it in the mid-90s, a lot of these manangs were still alive, and they were in their 80s and just amazingly open about their lives. And I was thinking about this the other day, and I was, for almost all of them, they were widows. And in their 80s, with their kids and their grandkids and even great-grandkids grown in a way, I felt like they spoke about their family lives with the freedom that they may not have had if I had interviewed them in their 50s or 60s. It was very interesting. You know, the ways in which they talked about the give and take of power and the kinds of power that they had as young Filipinas with such a skewed sex ratio imbalance. You know, and women talked to me about domestic violence, and they talked to me about Go boy. I talk about that phenomenon, that term that was coined in Hawaii for that phenomenon of a man coming, another Pinoy coming and stealing a wife, you know, cowboy her, right, to lasso her and take her away. And, you know, talking to more women about the kinds of freedom and power that they had, you know, because of the sex ratio imbalance and the fact that their parents and their grandparents and other elders that would normally control their behavior. And, you know, that changes the terrain of gender relations completely, for one. And then, two, the fact that divorce was legal in the United States. And that was something that no one had ever really talked about. Well, the exception of, you know, Auntie Dorothy Cordova's research was really pioneering in looking at Filipino women. I was always inspired, and really, she really helped me and mentored me when I was writing this thesis and also this book. But to think about women's power and how it increases with the sex ratio imbalance was something that I found that was really important, and that you see kind of throughout then the building of and continued building of this community, because women are so rare. that they occupy all these different places, these different positions in the community. They're mothers, their sisters, they're symbols of homeland. You know, they're sought after. You know, there's intense competition for lives. You know, so there's increased power, but there's also an increased burden. There's also incredible exploitation through queen contests. You know, they're working, you know, double days. They're working in the fields, and they're also responsible for the labor in the home. So, yeah, I was also careful to not romanticize this women's power either, you know, because it's like, okay, women have more power, but no one's helping them wash the dishes at the end of the day either, they may have more power, you know. But then there's also something to be said about being in a situation where you could leave your husband if you wanted to. That's something they could never have done if they'd stayed home in the province in the Philippines. You know, so, and the fact that they could really choose who they married. You know, even though I talk about women whose parents kind of chose their spouse for them. I mean, I talk about women, particularly second-generation women, who were born in the United States or in Hawaii in the 20s and 30s, who eloped. And so for all this talk of kind of this traditional Filipina, demure Filipina, you know, who listened to her parents and submissive and Catholic, I mean, the surprising number of elopements that people talked about were really, really interesting, because you see these American-born daughters really bucking, you know, their parents' expectations, and in many ways taking a cue from their own mothers whose power had increased when their immigration to the United States or through their marriage choices in the 1920s, you know, 10 to 15, 20 years prior. So, you know, so that was, I think that was, you know, working on gender and women is really one of the most important parts of the book for me, because that's something I really wanted to emphasize, that was one of the reasons why Stockton was the capital of Filipino America, because there were the most Filipino families there. And one of the reasons being is that if you had a family, you wanted them to be as kind of settled as possible, kind of near, you know, near institutions, near other families, near schools. You know, there were a lot of families that were migratory as well. But for many of these families, you know, they're out in Oakdale or out in Tracy or out in Lodi, I mean, you're still coming back to Stockton on the weekends. You're coming back to Little Manila. Mm. So there's that community there. And so it's the women and the families that really form the foundation for this larger community. And then many of these women become leaders. Mm. You know, the fact that there's so few of them really put them at the center of the family and the community. And so you have in the 30s, you have in the 40s and the 50s, women who are running for president of the Filipino community of Stockton, women who are, you know, delegates to the statewide Filipino community convention, you know, these kind of amazing women leaders in Stockton that, again, I really wanted to write into our Filipino American history, because in Takaki's account and Bulosan's account, they're really invisible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I found it very interesting that when you talk about power with Filipino women, especially in the book, you're not just talking about domestic power in the household. You're talking about public power. And
I mean, even the queen contest, as exploitative and as damaging as those were, I mean, women really learned how to use those to their advantage. I think women who realized, oh, I could, you know, I meet certain standards of beauty, or my family is politically powerful, I'm going to parlay the money that I make from these queen contests into my tuition for college, or into my clothes for school, or into buying food and furniture for my family. You know, so I'm going to use my position as an eligible woman to get men to buy groceries for my family, even, you know, to get men to do favors for my family, you know. So, I mean, I talk about that leads to a lot of jealousy and frustration on the part of Filipino men, and they know they're getting played, but what can they do? There are only three eligible Filipinas in Stockton, you know, and 500 men are trying to, you know, I'm not saying three, I'm exaggerating, but, you know, when you've got a limited supply of Filipinas, right, their price goes up. You know, and they certainly, and I only say that partly tongue-in-cheek, because they become commodified as well, so... There's an exploitation of their bodies, but then they're not victims either. you know, mm-hmm. and I really wanted to emphasize that, that there were women that said, no, I'm not going to do this social box thing. I'm not going to do this queen contest thing. But there were other women that said, if this is a way that I could make $1,000 for my family or for my college tuition, mm-hmm. well, so be it. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to use this as much to my advantage as I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the transnational history that you give of both the woman and Little Manila itself is really fascinating. I was hoping you could illuminate a little bit about how, as you claimed, Stockton was a kind of capital for Filipino Americans, but it also seems to me like it's part of the formation of Filipino American identity, coming from all these different ethnic backgrounds, linguistic backgrounds. People started to identify, I think, as Filipino Americans as they settled. So can you tell us a little bit about how that started to happen and women's role in kind of bringing disparate groups together?
Yeah. You know, I think coming from Stanford and coming from UCLA at that time, I was really, really influenced by books like George Sanchez's Becoming Mexican American. And you can really see that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I realized how, you know, people always talked about factionalism, but the more I realized how divided the community was and I really understood more about differences in dialect. I mean, growing up, by the 80s, 90s, you know, Filipinos, I mean, there were factions and there were divisions, but for the most part, you know, they had created community organizations, and my grandparents and my parents were really active in all these different community organizations. So I knew the Filipino community as, I imagined it as kind of this ahistorical, entity. Mm-hmm. And then the more that I delved into research for this dissertation and that became this book, I realized how alien all of these different groups must have seemed to one another when they all first got off the ship. And that's something mm-hmm. that you also see when you really read a lot of the oral histories that were done, you know, by Fons and other scholars and students in the 70s and 80s when this generation people were first doing these oral histories, when they talked about being on the ship and not being able to talk to anybody except for the people that were, you know, in their group, you know, that mm-hmm. had come from their town. I mean, I think there was this assumption that, well, everybody went to American colonial public schools, so they all spoke English, and that's how they all communicated. And for the most part, that's true. But at the same time, that didn't necessarily mean that they all saw each other as brethren, as kababayan. I mean, oh, yeah, they're also from the Philippines, but there's this affiliation that these early immigrants, attach to is really about their clan, their family, their village, and their region. And so, and then there are also these divisions of class. So you mm-hmm. have, for example, Sacadas coming over from Hawaii and their families coming into Stockton in the mid-1920s, people who had been organizing the sugar strikes and then been blacklisted from working in Hawaii and then decide that the mainland is going to be the better place for them. And they're mostly, you know, Ilocano or Visayan and coming from very, very kind of working class, kind of peasant stock because the HSPA, in their recruitment efforts, they wanted to make sure that people that they recruited were not literate. I mean, there were a lot of people that lied that actually were literate and came over through Hawaii. So we know that certainly was not the case. But so you have that population. You have the lower middle class of the provinces coming over from the provinces of the Visayas and northern Luzon, the Ilocos and Pangasinan areas. Many of them, like I said, they're not the poorest of the poor, but they have a little bit of land. They know English. They've gone to school up to at least maybe middle school or high school, and they're coming over in the hopes of going to college. Mm. And then you have the government-sponsored pensionados.
Mm.
You know, and they're in much smaller number. But so you've got those class differences, and linguistic differences, and regional differences, and I think that the racial violence and the brutal labor conditions that everyone is experiencing in Stockton, regardless of whether or not you are a pensionado from, you know, from the Ilocos region or you're, you know, coming over as a Sacada from Hawaii and you're mm-hmm. a Visayan. I think really that experience of being racialized into these brown others in Stockton, and I mean in America and then in Stockton specifically, really forces people to add, if not replace, and I don't mean replace their identities, you know, they go from Ilocanos to Filipinos, but they realize that they have, you know, they really have to come together. And they've got this identity that is, you know, imposed on them, whether they like it or not, as these brown debased savages, and in order to do anything about it, they're going to have to come together.
Mm-hmm.
And so my narrative is not really about so much that they come together and everything is fine. I mean, they're always going to have divisions. Mm-hmm. They're always going to be, you know, different factions in Stockton vying for political power, and a lot of it based on, you know, people coming from the same town or the same region or speaking the same dialect or, you know, cousins, et cetera, et cetera. But just that solidarity with one another as Filipinos is really born through their experiences in the field, their experiences with racial violence in Stockton, realizing that, you know, that education was not going to shield them from anti-miscegenation laws, for example, or from the same wages, you know, or the same lack of work opportunities or the same violence, you know. So that was something that I think people, it was kind of missing in Filipino-American historiography, you know, that coalescing, that coming together, that the fact that Filipino-American identity was something that was historical, and that we could understand how that identity kind of is forged and comes together. And then in the second half of the book, I talk about how their children, many of the second and third and fourth generation, they're all mixed up. They're Ilocano and Visayan and Tagalog. And so, and they don't know their regional languages or dialects. And they barely, you know, and they speak only English. So by that point, what use are, you know, they have no use for regional affiliations except for maybe, you know, the mutual aid organizations that their families belong to. But certainly they see themselves by the second and third and fourth generation as Filipino Americans. And those regional differences just are not that salient and not that important. They're bigger issues for them to deal with, things like redevelopment, racism, civil rights, you know, the Great Depression. So, and also I talk about how that Filipino-American identity is absolutely essential in Filipinos coming together in farm labor unions as well, because they realize, you know, they can't organize as Ilocanos, they can't organize as Visayas, you know. And they have to organize across, you know, these regional groups as Filipinos, because they're treated the same as Filipinos, and the only strength that they're going to have in winning these battles for worker justice and wages and work conditions is to come together as Filipinos.
Let's skip towards the second half of the book, where you start to talk about how Stockton has changed, especially since World War II. And you mentioned at the beginning of the interview that people don't seem to really, there doesn't seem to be much institutional remembrance of Stockton, as especially Little Manila itself. Can you just tell us kind of what happened after World War II, how the city developed and redeveloped?
Yeah, so what happens after World War II is something tragically that happens in most American cities in terms of redevelopment. Congress passes a law called the Housing and Slum Clearance Act, which basically gives money to municipalities to clear their slums. Now, the intent, at least on the part of housing activists and tenement reformers and kind of slum reformers, with the hope that substandard housing and tenement housing could be torn down and then replaced with better housing. Now, the problem with redevelopment as it was put into policy and practice after this law throughout the nation after World War II was that the cities, the neighborhoods and ethnic neighborhoods and working class areas of cities across the nation were targeted, demolished, cleared, thousands, if not millions of people displaced. And then replacement housing was not built. They were basically just kind of swept off of the face of the landscape. And this is what happens to Chinatown, Japantown, and Little Manila and Stockton after World War II. The city of Stockton identifies 9 blocks in what they consider Skid Row. And I talk a lot about this in the book, that Skid Row is in the eye of the beholder. For white, middle-class, and elite Stocktonians, they looked at the downtown area that was diverse. And with diversity, they saw slum. It didn't even matter if the building was falling down. The building could have been, a beautiful, historic example of, a certain kind of architecture. But if it was mostly black, mostly brown, mixed, it was considered a slum. Same thing that happens in the Fillmore in San Francisco, the South End, the Italian neighborhood in Boston, the Upper West Side in Manhattan, and the Puerto Rico neighborhood there, So you have in Stockton thousands of working class people displaced when the first urban redevelopment project comes through. So 9 whole city blocks just razed to the ground. And everyone basically told, move on. Nobody was given replacement housing. No one was even given relocation money. And you have to imagine that here are Filipinos who are renting in these old hotels and business owners who are leasing their storefronts from whites who own the buildings. Because Filipinos are not able to become citizens until 1946, after World War II. And so they don't own anything. This is their neighborhood, but they don't own any of the buildings. And so when redevelopment comes in, it's the white owners of the buildings who are, who are taking the rock bottom offers that the city of Stockton is giving them for their land and saying, okay, I'm out of here. I've made a little bit of money and I'm going. And, this essentially, the tragedy is that there was no organized opposition to it because people had not yet put together the idea that affordable housing and low-income housing were civil rights issues. It was seen, on the one hand, I think it would be too easy and cruel to say, oh, well, these Filipinos, they just sold out. They didn't protest. I mean, this is 1956. The civil rights movement hadn't even started yet. I mean, what were these poor guys supposed to do? Chain themselves to the bulldozers? Do some direct action boycott? I mean, we don't even see that until the late 1960s with the International Hotel. And that was a tragedy when I saw the fall of the Eye Hotel as an undergraduate. Yeah. And it moved me to tears. I just showed it to one of my seminars last night. And then realizing the same thing had happened in Stockton, but it was numerous hotels, it was dozens of hotels, all like that, everyone being evicted, their belongings thrown out in the street, and it had been such a painful thing that happened in Stockton that few old timers could even talk about it without getting emotional about, and also second and third generation Filipino Americans just seeing that pain of the old monongs walking around with nowhere to go in their old neighborhood. So after that redevelopment project, there were still 4 blocks left of Little Manila. And then the state of California decides that they want to build a freeway right through downtown Stockton to connect 2 larger freeways. One is the I-5, and the other one is a state highway called Highway 99. And then trucks need to get between those 2 freeways. Those are 2 main arteries in California. Well, the State Highway Commission decides, we'll put the connector freeway right through Stockton. And they decide on a route that cuts right through Little Manila. So 2 more blocks of Little Manila get destroyed. This is in the mid to late 1960s. And then that leaves just 2 remaining blocks. And again, these men are given here's $25 to find a new place to live. But where else are you going to live when most of the hotels in downtown Stockton have been demolished for redevelopment or for this freeway? So, and I talk about this in the book, a lot of Filipino organizations, buy small homes in South Stockton and house their elderly there. The Duguhoy Lodge in downtown Stockton was one place. The Iloilo Circle, the Caballeros de Masalang, many of these mutual aid and fraternal organizations built or converted their buildings into places where their elderly members could live out the last years of their lives. And then I talk about the movement for the Filipino Center in Stockton, which I think is I really, really wanted to write about this fight for the center because I think when we talk about development and reactions to redevelopment, the only story that we know in Filipino American historiography is the I Hotel. And I just caught Estela Habal's a wonderful book about the iHotel and the organizing around the iHotel. But Stockton's organizing around our Filipino-American center that was built in response to all the redevelopment. Nobody knows that history. And I wanted to write it. Lillian Galedo, one of the youth activists who was working on the Filipino Center, and she's director of Filipino Advocates for Justice in Oakland, you know, she was saying, you know, there are lessons to be learned from the struggle for this Filipino Center for all Filipino communities in Stockton. Mm. This history just had to be, you know, had to be written down and shared. So what ends up happening is that there's this kind of very progressive wing of the Filipino community that pushes for a Filipino American center, a affordable housing and retail, mm-hmm. and they're able to use housing and urban development funds, kind of war on poverty and great society funds, to get a mortgage for the center, and they just paid it off last year. And so that was one. I mean, and so we had to see this as one response that a Filipino community makes, you know, towards redevelopment, and certainly the iHotel is one response, right? You know, the mm-hmm. literally chaining of ourselves to the doors and refusing to go, and then Stockton struggle happening a full decade prior, and their response was to use these new liberal programs of the Great Society, the War on Poverty, to build this center, which was the first HUD-funded Filipino-American affordable housing project in the nation. And again, you know, this question of, well, what does this little cow town of Stockton have to offer to the rest of the community? I mean, most Filipino-American communities are still trying to build their community centers. Mm. You know, and Stockton did theirs 40 years ago in response to their original community being torn down. So a lot of lessons to be learned. And, I talk a lot about, you know, divisions and things like that. So.
Great. Have other groups or other organizations since, I think that you said the community center was in the 1970s when it was started?
Yeah, 1972 was when it opened.
Okay. What about since then? I think you mentioned some organizations at the beginning of the interview that are still trying to remember Stockton or is still trying to participate in that history.
Yeah. So, I haven't mentioned it enough, but I owe a huge debt to the Filipino American National Historical Society, headquartered in Seattle, and the Stockton chapter of FONS for really, you know, I wrote the book, but they are the ones that did all the oral histories for so many decades and kept carefully all of these archives and these photographs, you know, so I'm totally indebted to them. The National Board of Trustees of FONS designated the Filipino American National Museum to be in Stockton. And that was over two decades ago. And so we're hoping that can come together in the next few years. But I haven't yet talked about my own preservation work in Little Manila and Stockton. And I talk about this in the book. When I came to Stanford and kind of left L.A. and came back home, the city of Stockton was tearing down another block of Little Manila. And it hit even closer to home for me because it was one of the buildings that was going to go house my grandfather's restaurant. And then to add insult to injury, but they replaced it was also old hotels and stores, and there were moms in their 90s living in these hotels when they got evicted. You can imagine, for some of them, it might have been their third or fourth eviction after how many years. You know, to add insult to injury, these their block was replaced by a McDonald's and a 76 gas station. Wow. So for us, this was really about, well, Stockton, one, doesn't really care about its poorest residents. And then what does it say about how we feel about our Filipino-American history as Filipinos in Stockton if we allow our historic neighborhood to become parking lots, fast food places, and gas stations? And so we started the Little Manila Foundation in 1999, and we lobbied and successfully won from City Council the designation of the Little Manila Historic Site. So that's four blocks around the intersection of Lafayette and Alvarado Street. It also includes the freeway, but we want people to understand what the boundaries of the original community were. We placed signs, and we have banners all around the Little Manila Historic Site. And so in the Little Manila Foundation, we advocate for the preservation of the neighborhood and for educational programs so that people in Stockton will never have to do what so many of us had to do, to leave Stockton and to take an Asian American Studies course only to come back and say, wow, all of that happened in my own hometown. I didn't know it. So the Little Manila Foundation, working with the Stockton Chapter of FONS in many of these projects, we do an annual calendar. We host tours of Little Manila to hundreds of visiting college students and community members. Every year, we produced a Carlos Bulosan play. We actually bought the Mayi Theater Company that had done The Romance of Bagdo Rubio. And we had that performed in Stockton. And again, here was this play that Carlos Bulosan wrote while he was in Stockton, about Stockton. It had been performed in New York and performed in L.A., but the people in Stockton had never even seen it and didn't even know who Carlos Bulosan was, you know? So those are the kinds of things that we try to do to really raise awareness so that we could raise money to eventually, you know, hopefully buy and rehabilitate the last three remaining buildings in Little Manila. There are three buildings that are original to the neighborhood. One of them is the Mariposa Hotel, and Carlos Bulosan and Larry Itliong, Chris Gonsalves, had stayed there when they led the big 1948 asparagus strike. Next door is the Rizal Social Club, and that was one of the taxi cab halls that was owned by a Filipino in Stockton, and that was used by Black Eyed Peas as a backdrop for their video for Bebut. And they tried to recreate what it looked like, you know, in the taxi dance hall. And then next door to that is the Filipino Recreation Center, and that was built by the same entrepreneur as the Rizal Social Club. And that was where they showed Filipino movies. They had dances and union meetings, and then the whole bottom floor is a casino. But now, so what we want to try to do is for those buildings to stay there, and hopefully we can, you know, work with the owners to rehabilitate them. I mean, we don't really have the resources to buy everything now and rehabilitate them. The most important thing is to make sure that they're still standing. About 10 years ago in Stockton, there was a developer that wanted to tear it all down and build a 99 ranch and a Goldilocks there. And so that was a huge battle that we had in Stockton, and we were successful in driving that development proposal away. So we're very proud of that. So if folks want to go see our work, that's littlemanila.org. And you can also buy my book there, and all the proceeds will benefit the Little Manila Foundation. And we also do an annual Filipino-American history calendar. And so we're trying to do things that, you know, for people in Stockton that don't have that privilege or that access that we do to take these Filipino-American studies courses and to be graduate students and to be scholars in our field, to have access to the scholarship and the work that we're doing and to be proud of their history in Stockton, and also to question issues of oppression and racism in Stockton as well. So we started an after-school program, the Little Manila after-school program at my old high school, Edison High School in Stockton. And so we have several dozen students that learn Filipino-American history when they're high school students, something that we had, you know, we had all the moderns around us. We just didn't know the questions to ask, you know, when we were young. And so, you know, it's a hope that there will never be another generation in Stockton that will grow up not knowing how special their hometown was, or, you know, how important their grandparents and their ancestors were in not just Filipino-American history, but in the building of this state, in the building of this nation, and in the larger history of the American empire as well.
That's really inspirational. Well, Dawn, we've taken up a lot of your time. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're working on now? And I know this book just came out, so no rush to work on new things.
So there's a brand new anthology that just came out called Eating Asian America, and it's edited by Martin Manalansan, Anita Manur, and Robert Fu. And so it's a collection of scholarly essays about Asian American food. And I'm really happy that I have an essay there called As American as Jackrabbit Adobo, Cooking, Eating, and Becoming Filipino-American Before World War II. So it's about Filipino-American food across the West Coast, what people were eating and producing, and the kind of unique Filipino-American cuisine that emerges through the meetings of, you know, people from all over the Philippines coming together, and the resources they had in the United States, and the kinds of foods that people were processing and harvesting and working in. So you have dishes like jackrabbit adobo. You have seal adobo in Alaska. You have salmon head sinigang. You know, you have these very unique Filipino-American dishes that emerge from this immigrant and settlement experience that I talk about in an essay there. And that's going to be a larger book project. And I'd like to travel all across the country looking at the different ways that we cook and eat as Filipino Americans. Mm. And I mean, I think we have this amazing history as food producers, as harvesters, and as chefs. Mm. I mean, Filipino, the film The Butler, I think, is this really great history of African-American service in the White House. But we're also forgetting that Filipinos have served as stewards and cooks in the White House for decades before Cristeta Comerford gets there. So, you know, we've got Filipinos cooking in the White House as stewards. We've got Filipino Navy retirees opening up restaurants in Virginia Beach. You know, we've got all different kinds of the ways that we eat and Filipino-American food that are kind of rooted in our history, in our migration and our settlement patterns. So that could be my next big project. So it'll be recipes and pictures and oral histories, and I'm hoping that'll you know, I'll have, I'm doing this, the research now, a few more years, not 20.
Not as long as it took you to do this book.
This one takes a lot less time.
Well, great. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I think that sounds like an amazing project. So hopefully, if I'm still doing this, we can come back for that.
Great. Well, Christopher, I want to thank you so much for featuring Little Manila's in the Heart and having me on your program. Thank you so much.